Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Thompson. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Major Rick Bellis, and I represent the appellant, Private Thompson, in this appeal. Chief Judge Afron, with your permission, I ask that 3 minutes of my time be reserved for rebuttal. Beginning with the first granted issue, this court cannot say that the admission of appellant's redacted confession was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, that is, this court cannot say that the evidence contained in that redacted confession did not contribute to the contested findings at issue. At 3 points in the trial, the government used evidence contained in the appellant's confession to advance its case, beginning first with the trial counsel's opening statement, where he described the May 16, 2004 battery, of which appellant was ultimately convicted, as an incident where appellant grabbed and pushed Ms. Poufant up against one of the walls in the couple's apartment. That is the same words used by appellant in his February 7, 2005 confession given to investigator Rosamano. The second point in the trial where the government relied on appellant's confession was in the direct examination of investigator Rosamano. Investigator Rosamano was having difficulty recalling what appellant had said during that interrogation. The government used what was marked as Prosecution Exhibit 13 for identification at the time to refresh the investigator's recollection of appellant's confession. And then finally, during the argument on findings by the trial counsel, he again described the May 16, 2004 battery, of which appellant again was ultimately convicted, as an incident where appellant grabbed and pushed Ms. Poufant up against the apartment's wall, which is again the very same language uttered by the appellant on February 7, 2005.
So, with the government's concession on issue two, this is about the assault charge. If it is harmful, or not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, that is with respect to the assault charge.
May 16, 2004.
So this is about the assault charge, right? Would you be here if you were on the other accounts? Other charges?
Appellant is also arguing that the spousal kidnapping and the possession of child pornography are relevant to the evidence contained in the redacted confession. And the second point of my argument is that the crimes which appellant was ultimately convicted of, the spousal battery, the spousal kidnapping, and the possession of child pornography, are crimes of violence. Those inadmissible uncharged acts contained in appellant's redacted confession that went before the members.
Can you go through and point to the particular sentences in the statement that you find particularly alarming in terms of how they might indicate it contributed to the verdicts?
Yes, Your Honor. There are five instances. The first one being on Joint Appendix page 317. First instance where appellant is admitting to taking a digital picture of his genitalia and posting it on an internet dating website. On the following page, he talks about getting drunk beyond all consciousness.
Hang on. Say which paragraph you're in. So say on, they each start with on the blank date or whatever. Just make sure I line these up.
On page 317, which paragraph are you talking about?
Looks like it's the fourth paragraph down that begins with, in February 2004.
That's the first line. Okay, now you're on page 318?
Yes, Your Honor.
Which paragraph?
About halfway down. Again, I'm working off, there's a big blank because it's been redacted on Defense Exhibit Bravo, where he says in the middle of the page, while I was on leave, I got drunk beyond consciousness, and the next thing I knew was the next morning, and that's in relation to one of the batteries that was at issue. A little bit farther down in that middle paragraph there, also while I was on leave, I smoked marijuana one time at my friend's house with his wife. Turning to the following page, Joint Appendix 319, at the top, first sentence, I then punched Nick in the face and we started to wrestle around and fight. That's his roommate, Nicholas Austin, then he's referring to punching in the face. And then finally on Joint Appendix 321, in the middle of the page, have you ever physically abused your wife in the past, was the question posed to appellant. He responded, yes, I pushed her and grabbed her, not in an offensive way. And then have you ever verbally abused or shouted at your wife? And the appellant's response was yes. Now, a lot of that is obviously inadmissible, uncharged misconduct. However, it did go before the members, and the lower court gave no analysis, nor any consideration to the impact that that inadmissible, uncharged misconduct may have had on
the members. Can I just bring the point home here? Is it the essence of your argument, then, that those five statements, are what prejudiced the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that we should weigh those, whatever the government gets up and says, and whatever they wrote in their brief, we should weigh that against those five statements?
Yes, Your Honor. In determining whether those statements impacted the members' deliberations on the spousal battery, the spousal kidnapping, the possession of child pornography, which the appellant was ultimately convicted of.
How did the redacted confession get in?
Your Honor, that was actually admitted by the defense team.
Okay, and why is this not, insofar as there's error, why is this not invited error?
It's not invited error, Your Honor, because the genesis did not begin with the trial defense team. The genesis began on February 7th, 2005, when Investigator Rizzomano interrogated the appellant either knowing or in reckless disregard of the fact that appellant was already represented by counsel.
Well, what about the fact that appellant signed a waiver saying that he'd been advised of his rights and he wanted to make a statement? I mean, if you would like us to revisit the lower court's decision not to decide whether it had been incorrectly, whether it was an improper confession or not, just let me know.
No, Your Honor, the appellant's not seeking this court to revisit that issue, but in the lens of whether invited error should preclude appellant from arguing that that inadmissible uncharged misconduct contained in defense exhibit Bravo should be considered in the analysis of whether there was impact on the members during their deliberations.
The defense was the one that admitted the redacted confession and presented it to the members' counsel.
Yes, Your Honor, but I'm attempting to argue that it should not be invited error because the chain of events started with Investigator Rizzomano.
But all of that could be fine, well, and good, and but for the defense counsel's decision to admit it as evidence, none of that information would have been in front of the members.
Why don't you quickly state, so you can get it out, what your argument is, rather than give us the 14
But for the fact of Investigator Rizzomano conducting the interrogation, and then the military judge improperly denying the motion to suppress, and then the trial counsel marking appellant's confession as Prosecution Exhibit 13 for identification, which by all indications is that the government is going to intend to introduce this confession into evidence, and in fact they did, during the testimony of Investigator Rizzomano, elicit appellant's role in two of the four batteries, as well as the spousal rape. It was a reasoned response at that point in time for the trial defense team to embrace what they called that consciousness of innocence approach, which was probably the trial counsel is going to elicit further information from this confession, so we'll go ahead and put the whole thing in.
They took the chance. You're saying it blew up in their face, and therefore, it's error?
It's not invited error in that this court should not exclude from consideration that inadmissible uncharged misconduct.
They put it in.
They did, Your Honor, but only after the trial counsel had marked it in and elicited.
So the trial counsel, they're acting peremptory in a preemptive manner. This is a preemptive strike. I thought your argument was that having elicited testimony from the investigator about the statement, they were rounding it out.
They were rounding it out, Your Honor.
Well, how come you didn't say that? What you said instead was because trial counsel marked something on a sheet of paper, they rushed in and put the statement in.
Right, Your Honor. And if we look,
which is it?
It's both, Your Honor. And if we look at, if you give me,
how do we know that?
If you give me one moment to cite the joint appendix citation. And again, Your Honor, it's a little difficult to track because at one point you're on the record and then another point you're in an Article 39A session outside the presence of the members. But Joint Appendix page 176, in a couple pages previous to that, you have the trial defense team arguing, yes, we want to round out and complete appellant's confession, but also the trial defense team.
Well, no, hang on. I recommend that you actually give us the page site and the text.
Yes, Your Honor.
Rather than the spin.
176, Joint Appendix, very top, you have the Civilian Defense Counsel saying in relation to what is one of the reasons why you want to admit the redacted confession is I will be able to argue that as consciousness of innocence. And that was an appellate exhibit that the Civilian Defense Counsel had given to the court arguing that...
Okay, so that's the defense counsel saying I'm doing this on my own dime.
Well, right. Part of the reason that the civilian defense team, the defense team is seeking to admit this confession in its entirety is that they wanted to argue a consciousness of innocence. In fact, they had given the military judge a proposed findings instruction, and the theory being, appellant has admitted all these inadmissible uncharged acts, but you should believe him because he wouldn't have told you a lie on the rape, on the battery, on the possession of child pornography because he admitted all this other uncharged stuff. My point being is we don't get to that point in the trial, and that tactic would not have ever occurred but for the fact that the confession is into evidence, or at least is going to be admitted into evidence because the military judge denied the motion to suppress, and you have the trial counsel eliciting evidence from that confession during the direct examination.
Counsel, at what point in the trial was the confession admitted into evidence? Was it during the prosecution case or during the defense case?
It was during the cross-examination of Investigator Rosamondo. So it was the government's case in chief.
So it was during the government's case in chief.
Yes, Your Honor.
And your theory is that it was needed to address what the government was at that time pursuing as opposed to an independent defense strategy?
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, we know in...
Well, how do you fit that into the concept, then, of the consciousness of innocence? Isn't the consciousness of innocence a defense strategy as opposed to part of the cross-examination elicited as a result of anything from the confession that came in through the prosecution?
It apparently was a tactic embraced by the trial defense team at that point in time where, it's Joint Appendix 165 to about 181, 182, where apparently the trial defense team felt that now that evidence has been elicited through Investigator Rosamondo as far as what appellant has said, we need to embrace this consciousness of innocence strategy.
But that's the first part of that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The record says consciousness of innocence, but where's the first half of your sentence in the record reflected? The part about now that the testimony's come in through the investigator. Or is that reflected in the record, or is that your inference?
I'm not understanding.
Well, you said two things. You said your argument is on account of the investigator having brought in statements from the evidence from the statement.
During direct examination.
We felt, the defense felt it was necessary to then pursue this consciousness of guilt concept.
Right.
But the record page that you cited to only says we're pursuing consciousness of guilt. It doesn't say we're doing it because we feel compelled to do it because the investigator already alluded to the statement.
No, Your Honor.
Is there anything in the record that establishes that premise for you?
Other than the fact of the defense team marking an appellate exhibit and giving a proposed consciousness of innocence instruction to the members, or not to the members, excuse me, to the military judge, with thinking that later on when we get to findings, we want this theory instructed upon, it appears that that is what the tactic of the defense team is embracing at that point in time. My point being is you don't get to that tactic had evidence from appellant's confession never come in, because once evidence from appellant's confession comes in, certain defenses have been taken away. Alibi's been taken away. I was there, but it never happened has been taken away. You have appellant admitting in these batteries that there was a physical altercation. You have appellant admitting with respect to the rape that his wife said no, no, no for 15 minutes
Counsel,
prior to sexual intercourse occurring.
When we have a rule of completeness case, this would be a little bit clearer. Would it not? We would have the confession in, and then part of it, and then the defense would say, well, now you have to see the whole thing, and that's why it's not invited error. So is your point, the original three points you made, is that the confession was in because of the opening statement and because of the examination of Rosamondo? Okay. Now, then you mentioned five points of the confession that have hurt the appellant with respect to the other charges in the case. So my question is, why weren't those 5 points redacted? What possible benefit did the defense have in putting those 5 points in with respect to rebutting anything that the prosecution had done in the case?
I believe, Your Honor, the thinking was that if the members see that appellant has admitted to doing these other bad acts that are not charged, members are likely to think that appellant has come clean. So when he says he didn't rape his wife, when he says he didn't commit a battery against his wife, they'll believe him because he's admitted these other bad acts.
So the precise points that the defense thought at trial were going to help them are now the points that you are arguing to us are what hurt them.
Yes, Your Honor, but the point being is you don't get to that point but for the fact that the confession is an admissible document.
Which the defense counsel, that the government sought to not have the confession admitted. The government objected to the admission of the confession.
Well, not initially, Your Honor. They used it to refresh his recollection.
Using a document to refresh someone's recollection is not admitting a document as evidence, counsel.
No, Your Honor, but it is admitting what he said during the interrogation on February 7th, 2005, and that did come before the members on the spousal rape and two of the four spousal batteries. And the trial defense team certainly didn't know if there was going to be additional.
But my understanding of your argument here today is not that it was not the portions of the confession with respect to the spousal rape, et cetera, that hurt your client. It's today you're coming in and arguing that it was the portions of the confession that were uncharged misconduct.
Well, it's a multi-pronged argument. Yes, appellant disagreed with the lower court that there was evidence contained in the redacted confession that did relate to the offenses for which appellant was charged, specifically the spousal battery from May 16, 2004, and that the admission of that inadmissible uncharged misconduct likely spilled over into the members' deliberations on the spousal battery, the spousal kidnapping, and the possession of child pornography.
But wait a minute. You're saying the theory at trial was to put all this uncharged stuff in because then they'll think he's telling the truth. Now you're saying it spilled over and was baneful. Which is it?
Your Honor, looking at the lens and whether the admission of the confession was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, that is, how did it contribute to the outcome of the findings? An appellant is arguing that inadmissible uncharged misconduct should have never been before the members had this confession been properly suppressed by the trial judge. It wasn't. So the trial defense team is stuck with reacting to that admitted confession. And the way in which they did that, so that invited error should not apply in this case, was to argue consciousness of innocence and to round out appellants, investigators.
You can't have it both ways.
Counsel, you can respond. You can respond to that as a question.
I don't need a response. Thank you.
I will save my remaining 3 minutes for rebuttal and hopefully attend to issue number two.
Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Major James Wyrick, along with Colonel Louis Puglio, on behalf of the United States. The two issues before this Court, first relating to the confession, and second relating to did the lower court err in making its determination that reckless endangerment was a lesser included offense of the kidnapping charge.
Have you not conceded on issue two?
Yes, Your Honor, the government has, but would request that this court give some clarification to the lower court as to what exactly the lower court could find as a lesser included offense for the charge of kidnapping that was not found. Are they limited to...
Is that what you meant by reconsideration?
Of the lower court? Yes, Your Honor. To determine what exactly... It's clear that reckless endangerment is not a lesser included offense under any of the tests put forward by this court. That being, and the government would suggest that this court adopt or clarify that the test for determining if a charge is a lesser included offense under Article 59B is three-part. First, determine if the charge is a lesser included offense. Second, is it under the same theory of criminality That is to say, an appellate court cannot affirm a conviction on a basis of, or theory of liability not presented to the trier of fact. And third, is that lesser included offense factually and legally sufficient? Under the first step of that test, to determine if a charge is a lesser included offense, the court should first, or a lower court should look to first Article 79 of the UCMJ. Is the offense necessarily included in the greater offense?
Well, when you say necessarily included, are you talking about the elements test, or are you talking about something different?
Your Honor, we would have the elements test from Schmuck and Teeters, and that would be further informed, as this court stated last term by Medina, by the actual pleadings. So the elements test may be informed by the specification.
Why can't we do that here? Why would we have to send that back?
Because looking at the specification, Your Honor, it lists the appellant's name, did on active duty on or about 9 January 2005 willfully and wrongfully carry away and hold some or conflict against your will. It does not mention in a reckless manner or with or in a means that's likely to produce death or grievous bodily harm.
So then we could say, we can agree with you that they could not affirm an LIO of reckless endangerment, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So what is your theory as to the LIOs that are included on the face of that specification?
On the face of the specification, attempt would be included because that, under the third prong of the government's proposed test, that is listed in the manual as a lesser included offense of kidnapping. And so, as this court has held in U.S. v. Foster, 134, a simple disorder is always a lesser included offense. So a simple disorder of acts that are prejudicial to good order and discipline or service discredited.
Being a bad person.
Yes, Your Honor. Acts and then to the military detriment would always be a lesser included offense.
Counsel, in terms of notice, in terms of fact-finding that the court below has to engage in as part of its role, how do we have any idea in this case? Perhaps there are cases in which we can't approve a simple disorder, but how do we have any idea in this case what the simple disorder is that's being approved? Aren't we engaging in fact-finding and fact-determination then if we're the ones who approve it? But we can probably figure out a legal way to do that and cite all the right authorities. But as a practical matter, doesn't someone have to sort out what the facts are here and figure out what the simple disorder is? And isn't that the function of the CCA and perhaps even the fact finder at trial?
Yes, Your Honor. It would be one of the fact-finding bodies that would have to determine first what the acts are and then it was prejudicial or service discrediting. Now, that has been done, and that was instructed on at trial, at joint
but
appendix.
That was instructed on in the context of an offense which the Court of Criminal Appeals said didn't exist. How do we know that the members didn't find him guilty of wouldn't have found the element of prejudice to good order and discipline or service discrediting conduct based upon the charge which they thought was a legitimate charge? After all, don't we all the time have the argument made before us that you can infer service discrediting or prejudicial conduct based upon the offense itself?
Yes, Your Honor, and the enumerated articles under the UCMJ, according to this court, do embrace prejudicial conduct or service discrediting conduct.
Well, but we've had some thoughts about that lately, but putting that one aside, if the members could infer from the charge that there was service discrediting conduct or conduct prejudicial to good order and discipline, how do we know that they didn't do this in the present case with respect to the charge that the Court of Criminal Appeals found to be not a lawful charge?
In
other words, we don't know in this case, do we, that they found the element of service discrediting or prejudicial and good order or discipline based upon some particular facts of this case that are separate from the unlawful charge?
Well, Your Honor, we do know that for the kidnapping charge, they did find that because of Joint Appendix 266, they were instructed that that was one of the elements of...
Exactly. But why couldn't they, in this case, have not inferred that element based upon the charge itself? They often do that. They often, and that is the government's argument often before this court, that there need not be any direct evidence on the issue of either service discrediting conduct or conduct of prejudicial good order and discipline, because you can infer that the act that was charged was discrediting or was prejudicial good order and discipline based upon the charge itself. You can infer the third element from the first element.
Yes, Your Honor.
And now we find in this case that the first element was illegal. The court below said you can't, that this case wasn't proved. So how do we know that the panel in this case made an independent determination that there was something about this offense separate from the charge that made it service discrediting?
I'll have to give a bit of a compound answer, I
sure.
believe, to that, Your Honor. First, as far as direct evidence of service discrediting conduct, there are numerous elements throughout a crime that aren't given direct evidence. We are not given direct evidence on. For the mens rea for a crime, there may not be direct evidence on there, but there's circumstantial evidence that the trier of fact can then find on. So the service discrediting or prejudicial conduct wouldn't differ in any way from those
right. other elements. So those facts may be somewhere in the record, but how do we know that this panel, or at least this Court of Criminal Appeals, would have found those facts with respect to the fact-finding responsibility beyond a reasonable doubt? They could have found beyond a reasonable doubt that those elements were satisfied based upon the charged offense, which is now no longer before us.
So, Your Honor, is the question, without the asportation element, that then taking those other elements that are still there, can the court determine that that was service discrediting?
Right. They may have found that his conduct was service discrediting because they felt he was guilty of kidnapping.
Yes, Your Honor. That is absolutely correct.
But so what do we do with that now?
Because this is a lesser included offense. That would be the same for any lesser included offense, that you take away one of the elements and the lesser.
Which is a lesser included offense?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Are you talking about the attempt? Are you talking about the simple disorder? What
the
are you
simple disorder is lesser included offense, Your Honor, because it's charged under the
What are the elements of the simple disorder?
Conduct that is prejudicial to good order and discipline, or service discrediting.
Anything.
Acts, yes, Your Honor.
Any act.
Any acts that the trier of fact can determine are prejudicial to good order and discipline or service discrediting.
Well, how do we know if they've done that?
Because they're finding. Because they were instructed on that. They were given the acts. And then they had to have found it was service discrediting because they were instructed, and we presume that members follow the instructions that they're given by the military judge.
Okay. But do you see how circular this reasoning is? I mean, you're saying that because they found the act and were instructed that they also had to find that it was service discrediting, that therefore we can be certain that they would find it was service discrediting even if they might not have found the act if they had been properly, that basically an act that they shouldn't have found that he was guilty of. The carrying away.
This is a very lengthy concession.
This area of law is a model of clarity.
Are you trying to avoid a rehearing? You asked for us to send this back to the CCA for reconsideration, which is not something we do. You say reverse the CCA, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, let's use the words that we normally use. Reverse, not reconsider. Second, what you're really arguing now is reverse them, but then tell them all the things they can affirm so that we don't send it back for a rehearing on findings. Is that what this is about?
Yes, and asking this court, Your Honor, to clarify what the maximum punishment
but you're,
is.
But you're looking for clarification in the context of saying, go ahead and affirm all these other things.
Yes, or in the alternative, this court may confirm on a simple disorder and determine that it need not be sent back to the...
But didn't you say that one of the three things for your test for determining LIO was whether the LIO was factually and legally sufficient? We can't determine whether it was factually sufficient, can we?
Yes, you can, Your Honor, because it's a lesser included offense. Because he was definitely on notice of acts that were service discrediting, and because it is a known lesser included offense, this court can find it was factually sufficient.
This sounds like the great old English case of the guy jumping off the bridge, and the judge said, well, there's no statute that covers jumping off the bridge, but we ought not to have people jumping off bridges, therefore he's certainly done something for which he should be held criminally responsible.
Or the case of United States versus Bivens, Your Honor, where we have bigamy being charged under 134, where the element of the accused being married is absent, that he was marrying someone who was married. And that's a different element than that listed in the MCM. Nonetheless, that was found to be a simple disorder chargeable under 134, Your Honor.
On issue one, did the government elicit statements from the investigator regarding the appellant's statement or not before the defense brought it in?
They did not.
Did you understand that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. Anything related to the...
Did the government open the door to introducing the whole statement because they got the investigator to say what was in the statement in part,
other than marking it as a prosecution exhibit but not admitting it in the evidence? No, Your Honor. It was just marked. It was never offered by the prosecution. It was clearly only offered.
But nor were the statements offered by the prosecution in the mouth of the investigator.
That's correct, Your Honor.
When the prosecution used the statement to refresh the recollection of the witness, what did the witness testify to with respect to any statements made by the accused appellant in this case?
I'd have to refer to the joint appendix on that, sir, but it did not go to the any of the crimes for which appellant was convicted.
But they did it go to crimes for which he was charged and then on trial? Did the witness testify as to any statements made by the appellant in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. In my understanding of the theory of the defense...
You're changing your answer to my question.
Or it was the identification that the investigator had spoken to the witness. That's why that was used as to refresh his recollection.
And the statements that made by appellant that the investigator testified about, did any of them go to offenses for which he was charged and found guilty?
Not that he was found guilty. So which he was acquitted, yes, as to the assault on his wife, one of the assaults on his wife, the assault that happens in Texas, and the rape of his wife. Those were all charges for which he was acquitted.
Now, this is my understanding of the defense theory, not my theory, the defense theory of the case, and if I get it wrong, the defense can correct it on rebuttal, that the prosecution introduced evidence of statements made by the appellant through the witness with respect to charged offenses. the defense then felt it was necessary to, as a result of introducing those statements, which the defense had previously tried to suppress unsuccessfully, that the defense then felt it was necessary to introduce everything that the defendant had said, including all this uncharged misconduct. And therefore, it's not invited error because it was the prosecution that first put into evidence statements made by the appellant to this investigator. Now, is that an accurate description of the sequence of offense, of the events?
Yes, Your Honor.
I understand. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. And then, obviously, as the court knows, that the lower court then determined that to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because both those statements went to crimes for which appellant was not convicted, and the judge gave the correct instruction to not allow spillover.
With respect to the Van Arsdale factors, which are highly fact-specific, why in this case, in view, if we were to otherwise remand the case, is there any reason why we shouldn't ask the Court of Criminal Appeals, which is going to be focusing on the facts of this case, to give us a answer on the Van Arsdale factors that's addressing each one of those factors as opposed to simply an assertion that Van Arsdale is complied with?
Yes. If this is remanded, there's no reason that this court could not require the lower court to articulate more clearly those
factors. Certainly we could do it, but I think the question was, should we do it?
It's the government's position that there's no need to do it, that there's not a requirement for the lower court to articulate those, but it is possible, Your Honor.
Would you agree that it's a better practice for the lower court to set forth in its opinions that it has looked at each of the Van Arsdale factors and balanced them?
Obviously, Your Honor. As a trial or appellate court, they're always informing this court more clearly if they lay out the factors and the final answer. That would be the better practice. There are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
I do, Your Honor.
Can you straighten something out for me? Can you show cite to the record pages where the government uses the statement for something other than recollection of the, you know, witness recalling, whatever you say that is?
That was going to be my first point on rebuttal, was to clarify the timeline of events if, in fact, there is any confusion. And it's Joint Appendix page 159, where the trial counsel is conducting the direct examination of Investigator Rosamano, and in the middle of Joint Appendix 159, question is posed to the investigator, at some point, were you able to take a statement from the accused, Private Thompson? The response was, yes, sir, I was. If we turn the page to Joint Appendix 160, we have the witness testifying what the accused told him in that interrogation on February 7th, 2005, with respect to two of the four batteries that are on the charge sheet. And then in the following two pages, Joint Appendix 161 and 162, you again have testimony coming in through Investigator Rosamano as to what appellant said occurred during the alleged rape, which is Ms. Buffon said no sex for 15 minutes, but she finally conceded sexual intercourse transpired. We don't get into the markings of the redacted confession as defense exhibit Bravo and so forth and the consciousness of innocence until after this has already occurred on the record before the members. Additionally, I wanted to point out Appellate Exhibit 45, which is not contained in the joint appendix, but that is actually the memo of law that the trial defense team provided to the military judge in an attempt to advance their consciousness of innocence strategy, which only came to light once the confession had been referenced by Investigator Russomano during the trial counsel's direct examination. I may briefly touch on the second issue, and then I will be done. This court should resist any temptation, if there is in fact any, to affirm a simple disorder or neglect based upon what the lower court found to be factually and legally insufficient, which was the carrying away and the holding, allegedly, of Ms. Poufant. And the danger is that appellant would simply not have been on any type of notice as to exactly what conduct was the simple disorder or neglect. And you have double jeopardy concerns as well, stemming from what exactly was it on that night of January 9th, 2005, out in front of their apartment, that exactly was in fact a simple disorder.
What's your position on what I take to be the government's view that, you know, and he obviously did something bad, and so he can be convicted of doing something bad?
The time to argue that has since passed. The trial counsel should have, in anticipation of possible lesser included offenses, after those instructions given to the members. That time has since passed, and certainly every offense has a potential LIO of a simple disorder and neglect. That would not be appropriate to affirm in this case, with the specific findings by the CCA that those two elements of kidnapping, that is the carrying away and the holding, were not established beyond reasonable doubt. There are no further questions. That concludes my argument. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 9:45 a.m.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 9:55 a.m.